Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. First, we'll go to New York and get an update on the superstorm making landfall on the northeast coast right now. Phil Aranoniu, the U.S. campaign director and co-founder of 350.org, joins us. On Sunday, he, Bill McKibben, and other activists unfurled a giant banner, End Climate Silence, in Times Square. Also joining us is Joseph Nevins, who teaches geography at Vassar College. He has an article at Al Jazeera, Ecological Crisis and the Need to Challenge the 20%. Then we will speak with the Nation Institute's investigative reporter, Lee Fong, about the dark money fueling the Romney campaign and their massive phone banks targeting the swing states that could overcome the supposed advantage that the Obama campaign has in terms of their ground game in Ohio and other critical states. We will look into the hidden role of the oligarchs and corporations who do not have to reveal the extent or the means with which they are supporting the Romney campaign. Then finally, we'll speak about California's Proposition 34 that will ban the death penalty and, if passed, very likely have considerable national implications for ending capital punishment. We will speak with Bruce Liska, who at the age of 17 was wrongfully convicted of murdering his mother. Bruce spent 26 years in prison for a crime he did not commit and barely avoided the death penalty. Thanks to investigative journalism by the Los Angeles Times, he was exonerated and is now suing the LAPD. Joining us now is Phil Aranoniu, an environmental activist and co-founder and U.S. campaign director of 350.org. On Sunday, activists with 350.org unfurled a giant End Climate Silence banner in Times Square. And also joining us is Joseph Nevins, a professor of geography at Vassar College. He has an article at Al Jazeera, Ecological Crisis and the Need to Challenge the 20%. Welcome to Background Briefing, Phil Aranoniu and Joseph Nevins.
Thank you, Ian.
And Phil, are you there?
Yep.
Good. So let me begin with you, Phil. Tell me about what you did yesterday in Times Square.
Yeah, absolutely. Just before the subways closed down in New York City, we went down to Times Square, which was eerily empty, and we met a number of climate activists, folks from Occupy Wall Street and a number of other groups to send a message to our political leaders that we want them to talk about climate change as if it's real, because it is real.
So, Joseph Nevins, what do you see outside of your window? You're also in New York on the Hudson River. I take it that the storm is pretty much making landfall now on the New Jersey coast, right?
That's correct. Actually, I can't see much because all the streetlights are out.
I see. Right.
While I have electricity in the house, I'm not sure that's going to last very long.
Well, let's hang in there, hopefully. Tell me, though, given what's going on here, in watching this campaign, both presidential campaign candidates have been pretty silent on climate change. The president did speak about it on MTV. But while the candidates are not speaking about climate change, it would seem that climate change is speaking to them.
Absolutely. I mean, they can ignore it all they want, but they're going to have to face the consequences in all sorts of ways. I mean, it's very striking looking at not only listening to the debates, but looking at the campaign websites of the two candidates. And on neither one of them do they talk about environmental issues. The closest the Obama campaign comes to that is talking about energy uses, energy matters. And at the top of the list is the Obama campaign's commitment to make sure that we have low gas prices, gasoline prices at the pump, so we can continue drive with abandon. And then toward the bottom, he begins to talk about green energy, but nothing about conservation or the need to sort of scale back our rapacious consumption, on a collective level, nor of particular institutions like, say, the U.S. military, which by itself is the largest producer of greenhouse gas emissions on an institutional level.
And, of course, the Republicans in Congress have tried to stop the U.S. Navy from using alternative fuels for their fleet. Phil Aranoniu, the Travelers Insurance have released a pamphlet with data compiled by the German reinsurance giant Munich Re. which basically is a 300-page report called Severe Weather in North America. This is a compiled evidence from 1980 to 2011, suggesting the overall losses from weather catastrophes have been over $1 trillion in 2011 dollars, including $500 billion in insured losses. And Hurricane Katrina itself accounted for some $125 billion in losses, and roughly 30,000 people lost their lives due to weather catastrophes in North America in the 30 years examined by the report. So if the insurance people are starting to wake up, is that in fact about the only wedge that we can see out there? You got the oil companies funding denial. Maybe the insurance companies are going to start funding reality.
Yeah, it's not surprising that Chevron just made a huge donation to the Romney campaign, about $2.5 million just a couple days ago, to ensure that that their candidate gets elected. I think we're in a really big fight with the fossil fuel industry. Like the tobacco industry, they're an industry based on killing people. The product that they produce is carbon fuel, and that carbon goes into the atmosphere and warms the earth. And we're seeing the results now. But there has to be a wake-up call at some point. The politicians really have to understand that they can't keep silent on this issue and that they really need to deal with it. And hiding behind energy and hiding behind other issues, they have to take responsibility for what's a real issue that they're going to have to deal with. I think what Sandy is showing us is that it's not an issue just for our kids or the future, which is the line that Obama used in his MTV interview, but that it's an issue for now, that people are really suffering now.
And again, Joseph Nevins, professor of geography at Vassar College. You have an article at Al Jazeera, Ecological Crisis and the Need to Challenge the 20%. The point of your article, of course, is that here in the United States, with one-fifth of the world's population, we consume, 20% of the energy? And until we and the rest of the industrial nations understand the extent to which we're both burning energy at a profligate rate and, in effect, encouraging others to do so, it's a bit like the arms race, isn't it, where the nations with the most nuclear weapons, the Russia and the United States, in order to stop proliferation, they've got to start reducing their arsenals. Is that an argument you're making?
I mean, in many ways, yes. I mean, and at the same time, I concur with Phil saying in that we really have to focus on a lot of these large institutional actors whose survival and so-called success depends on, necessitates rapacious consumptions of fossil fuels. At the same time, I think we have to avoid making a distinction between sort of a simple distinction between sort of an us and them, because their very existence is predicated on our cooperation, our buying in to what they need. In other words, we're the ones that are ultimately, as individuals, as a society, consuming large amounts of fossil fuels. And so in that regard, we have to question our very way of life. In the case of the United States, we're a little less than 5% of the world's population, but we use about 25% of all carbon-based fuels. And in the article that I wrote for Al Jazeera, what I'm pointing out is that it's that 20% on a global level, which includes the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and elites in a small number of other countries that are responsible, contemporarily, for about 80%, 20% of the world's population responsible for about 80% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And if we look at it historically, that 20%, that one-fifth slice, is responsible for even a larger portion than 80%. And of course, what we're seeing in terms of the climate front is just one component, albeit a very important and alarming one, in a generalized ecological crisis. I mean, we face crises on numerous fronts: deforestation, the demise of the coral reefs, the overfishing of most of the world's fisheries, ocean acidification, toxic waters, toxic soils. According to the FAO, about one quarter of the world's, the FAO is the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, but one quarter of the world's soils are severely degraded or in the process of being severely degraded. And this is, again, it's tied into our very way of organizing our society on a global level, and a way of organizing society that's driven largely by a very small percentage of the world's population. So we have to think of our consumption and be critical of it in the same way we'd be critical of our acts to the extent they fuel racism or empire or classism, right? Because who gets what ecologically, who calls the shots, is similarly based on a structure of injustice.
And Phil Aranonu, who's an environmental activist and the co-founder and U.S. campaigns director for 350.org, how do we, given, of course, that this campaign has been have avoided any discussions about the obvious connection between global warming and the weather that now is striking the northeast coast of the United States in what the mayor of New York has called the storm of the century? It's just making landfall now. And we're both grateful that both of you still have lights on and electricity and your phones are working. The Romney campaign, of course, are talking about the need for energy and jobs and North American independence. So none of the debate is anything like where it should be, according to what Joseph Nevins just told us. I know you're trying to do. You're trying to remedy that with 350.org. Is it Pavlovian? Do we have to suffer a lot in order to wake up? What's your answer there?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think the initial discussion around climate change a few years ago was a lot more about driving less and changing our lifestyles, and I think those are definitely important starting places. But look, if we all switch our light bulbs and decide to drive Priuses instead of Hummers, the numbers just don't add up. We won't get to 350 parts per million in time. What really needs to happen is we really need to take on the fossil fuel industry straight on. The reason we haven't had climate legislation in this country or an international deal is because these fossil fuel companies, Shell, Exxon, Chevron, these companies have spent billions of dollars selling misinformation for 20 years, saying that the climate crisis isn't real. It's wrong. We need to take a moral stand, and that's the fight that we're. It's really a fight to the death. It's either we win this or there's no planet left, and that's why we're launching a new campaign right after the election called "Do the Math." We're taking Bill McKibben, another one of our founders, an environmental author, on a 20-city tour around the United States to send this message to folks that this is a movement, that we have an opportunity to stand up and fight for what's right and fight for clean energy and what needs to happen and make sure that these fossil fuel companies get the message. And you can check that out at math@350.org.
And Joseph Nevins, just in closing in the last minute, what do you think it's going to take for us to change? Because you're talking about a cultural change, a psychological change, as well as a political one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think these what Phil and I are talking about are mutually exclusive. And what I would say is that they're necessarily linked. I mean, obviously, if I stay at home and do nothing, that in itself isn't going to change anything. Right, so of course we need to be, Derek Jensen wrote an article a number of years ago called "Forget About Shorter Showers." He's saying if you think, by reducing your shower time that you're going to change, help save the planet, forget about it. Obviously, we need to act on an institutional and collective level first and foremost. At the same time, I just know too many, climate scientists, climate activists, environmental justice activists who don't think twice about living a high consumptive lifestyle, right? They fly everywhere. One flight round trip between New York and Los Angeles is the equivalent of 2 metric tons of greenhouse gases, the equivalent of what a typical Brazilian uses in a year. I mean, it's sort of the equivalent of saying, I'm against institutional racism, but I don't care about my own racist practices. We need to put these two things in dialogue, and rather than seeing them as mutually exclusive, figure out how we socialize, we move from individual change up to institutional change, and the reverse, how institutional change is going to be linked to individual change. But we have to call into question our individual lifestyles and to be critical of it. And I think one reason elements of the environmental movement are afraid to do that is because they're afraid they're going to lose people, right? And I think the message that we all too often send is that if we just get the technologies right, if we move to clean energy, green energy, we can have our cake and eat it too. And again, it's not just a climate crisis. It's a crisis on many levels, and it's tied into our consumption. So yes, we need to act politically. We need to focus on institutions. We need to push our elected officials to do the right thing, which is, you know, radically change our energy consumption patterns and the modes of our energy. But at the same time, we have to challenge ourselves and those around us. And when we're talking, you know, to an audience like we're talking to, and people like who we are, we're the people that are the source of the problems. We have to challenge ourselves as well.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Phil Arononiou, who's the environmental activist, co-founder of, and U.S. campaigns director of 350.org, and Joseph Nevins, professor of geography at Vassar College. He has an article at Al Jazeera, Ecological Crisis and the Need to Challenge the 20%. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Romney's hidden ground game. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lee Fong, who's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He covers money and politics, conservative movements and lobbying. His work has resulted in multiple calls for hearings in Congress and the Federal Election Commission. His book on the campaign to block Obama's domestic priorities is slated for publication this winter. And he has an article at the Nation, "Does Romney Actually Have a Bigger Ground Game Than Obama?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Lee Fong.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And before we get to Frank Vandersloot, who's, I think, the single biggest contributor through his super PAC to the Romney campaign and co-chair of Romney's National Finance Committee, your article at The Nation, "Does Romney Actually Have a Bigger Ground Game Than Obama?" points out that even though we're often told how many field offices Obama has in Ohio, I think four times as many as Romney, at the end of the day, we don't quite know, I take it, whether these rich oligarchs and powerful employers who have been communicating with their workers about how they should vote and essentially saying if you vote for Obama, you know, you're going to lose your job. We don't know the extent to which they've organized a ground game, I take it, in terms of not just urging their employees to vote for Romney, but maybe driving into the polls. Is that what's going on under the radar here?
Well, that's right. You know, there's two dynamics at play here. One is that the right, conservatives, have made a focused investment in organizing institutes and organizations that are devoted to grassroots organizing. Many of these institutes are 501c organizations, meaning they don't have to report their finances. So there's literally about 15 of these institutes that have been set up over the past 4 years. Many of them were involved in the Tea Party movement. Now they're devoting significant resources to turning people out to vote. And we don't know how much they're spending because they're 501c's. They're these shadow organizations. At the same time, Citizens United, this landmark decision from the Supreme Court in 2010, has liberated big employers to communicate with their employees like they never could before, to basically tell them which candidates they support, to endorse candidates, and some of them are even offering rides to the polls, doing the kind of ground operations that a campaign would ordinarily do. And again, many of these corporations don't report their finances to the Federal Election Commission or any of these types of electioneering efforts. So we have these dark money groups and these large corporations playing the role that a traditional campaign committee would, except there's no disclosure. So if you look at the campaign reports, on paper, Obama has more field organizers, more field offices than Romney, but that disclosure picture doesn't really account for everything that's happening in the country right now.
Well, I just on Thursday did an interview with Nate Silver, who's with 538.com, and he, of course, has Obama ahead in Ohio. And we talked actually about the last election in Nevada, and of course, Nevada is a key state for Romney. And Nate admitted that he got it wrong last time, that Harry Reid surprised everybody. They had bet on Sharron Angell, but he surprised everybody because of his network. But I think what people aren't recognizing is that the Harry Reid network is essentially a Mormon network, and Harry Reid's a Mormon. And so it's quite possible that the Harry Reid network, in fact, likely that the Harry Reid network will elect Romney in Nevada and one of its biggest activists, the richest man in Idaho, who is the biggest supporter of Romney's and the co-chair of his campaign, is Frank Vandersloot, a very powerful figure in the Mormon Church. You're saying here that he basically, most of these calls that are going into these swing states originate out of Idaho Falls and Rexburg, Idaho, where Frank Vandersloot has essentially dedicated his multi-level marketing corporation that sells dietary supplements and cleaning supplies to the disposal of Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers outfit.
Yeah, it's a remarkable dynamic. So, you know, at first we had the campaigns, the Romney campaign, outsourcing a lot of their ground operations to these Koch brother type groups, Americans for Prosperity, that are barnstorming the country, busing volunteers, making phone calls to swing states. Now we have even Americans for Prosperity outsourcing their operations to another third party, Frank Vandersloot's corporation, which is very adept at direct-to-consumer marketing. That's basically all he does. He sells dietary supplements and cleaning supplies. And his company has been accused of running a pyramid scheme in the past because they'll recruit people and promise money or other rewards for recruiting their friends and family to do the same. So they're very good at this type of direct marketing that actually is very important in a campaign because it's all about person-to-person persuasion this late in the game. You know, the television advertisements, the radio advertisements, they kind of have a diminishing appeal once you get one or two weeks out of an election. People kind of tune it out. So the only thing that really matters right now are the type of efforts where you bust people to the polls, where you actually communicate door-to-door, and where you make these pivotal phone calls. And, most of the mainstream media is ignoring the fact that these huge call centers that Frank Vandersloot is donating basically to the Romney campaign by way of the Americans for Prosperity, they could have a significant impact in the election.
So specifically, you've got legions of these young teenagers in Idaho hired for $10 an hour making anti-Obama calls to swing states. Is that what they're actually doing?
That's right. And it's not just in Idaho. I mean, they've set up these call centers all over the country, in San Diego, in Texas, in places where there aren't competitive elections. They're basically bringing in volunteers, or they're paying folks to make these calls to swing states. And, you know, mind you, both Obama and Romney are bringing people together to make calls. The difference here is that this is outsourced. This is a private organization that doesn't report its finances, so we don't know the full picture. But Americans for Prosperity got in a little bit of trouble with this Idaho example because they were caught recruiting teenagers at their high schools, telling them that they'll be paid $10 an hour. And, you know, a lot of the parents aren't very happy with their kids being recruited into something so partisan and, you know, without the parents' consent either.
Well, you know, Li Fong, this Frank Vandersloot, he came to my attention recently when the Boy Scouts of America's perversion files were released under an order by the Oregon Supreme Court. I spoke with the investigative reporter who originally broke the story for the Idaho Falls Post-Register, Peter Zuckerman. And he told this just stunning story that this, the richest man in Idaho, this fellow Frank Vandersloot, personally tried to stop this story. He took out hate ads against the reporter in newspapers. He harassed the reporter's sources. He eventually outed the reporter, who was gay, causing his partner to lose his job. But nevertheless, he managed to get the series published, and he won a lot of journalistic prizes for it. So that, you know, the question that arises is, why is this Mormon billionaire covering up for child molesters in the Boy Scouts? It's very, very troubling. I'm not suggesting that in any way that Frank Vandersloot is a pedophile, but on the other hand, you have to ask yourself, why did he go to such lengths to suppress this story, and what kind of guy is he?
Well, this is just another example, in my opinion, of the type of plutocratic shenanigans that our country is moving into. You know, Frank Vandersloot was called out by the Obama campaign for financing the Romney super PAC. But, I mean, which is fair. I mean, he really did give millions of dollars to the Romney super PAC. But Frank Vandersloot said he was being victimized. He was being placed on the president's enemies list. He went to all of these conservative news outlets and said that, you know, President Obama was acting like Nixon and sending his henchmen after him. I mean, it was a little bit paranoid, to say the least. But in an election where you have basically all attention and all political resources devoted to and controlled by just a small group of very wealthy individuals, really, we're at the whim of whatever they decide to do. If you have a David Koch or a Charles Koch or a Frank Vandersloot that decides to just put a small portion of their wealth into some cause or into some election, they have incredible sway. So, you know, if there's an eccentric billionaire that wants to have great influence in this country, now there's basically no limit for what they can do.
So do we know what we don't know who these groups are? And this is why you're making the point here, Li Fong, that in spite of the advantage that Obama appears to have in field offices, which I think people make the assumption that he has a stronger ground game with 131 field offices in Ohio to Romney's 40. The point that you're making here is that we don't know the extent to the hidden field game that Romney has because of these organizations funded by these plutocrats, one of which, of course, is Frank Vandersloot, who is a specialist in telemarketing. That's how he made his millions and billions. Then we don't know whether corporations are hiding behind these 501c4 social welfare vehicles. We don't know how much money they're giving in the first place. We don't know how much their corporate assets, like transportation, etc. We know that they're influencing the vote. We know that, for example, Cintas, a big company in Cincinnati, has told its employers that if they don't vote for Obama, they're going to lose their jobs. We know that Murray Energy in Ohio forced their employers to appear as in a photo op with Mitt Romney. So that, I guess that's the troubling aspect. We've talked about phone banks. What other things do you think they're up to that we don't know about?
Well, one of the big efforts by Americans for Prosperity, American Action Network, some of these other conservative 501c groups, is to barnstorm the country through bus tours. So they have kind of mobile field operations. Right now, I believe they've got 3 or 4 bus tours crisscrossing the country going to the swing states. And what they do is that they partner with local Tea Party organizations, and they go into a state. They have a little rally with a speaker, sometimes like a conservative celebrity, an Ann Coulter type, bringing people out, collecting names, and then deploying them to get out the vote. Some of these groups, like the Republican Jewish Coalition and Americans for Prosperity, are distributing iPads and Samsung Galaxy tablets, and they're already pre-programmed with door-knocking schedules, with who to talk to, and they're basically synchronized. So the data that is being collected as these Tea Party activists or Republican volunteers go out and door-knock, they beam that information back to headquarters, and it's distributed so that the phone bankers, whether they're in Idaho Falls or Virginia or where have you, have better information for who to contact, who to remind, and who needs a ride to the polls come election day. So it's a very integrated effort. Republicans historically have been at a disadvantage in these type of field operations compared to Democrats, but I think this year could be a real game changer. Even if Obama is victorious on election day, I think Republicans have really made an effort we haven't seen in previous years, and we'll see the effect down ballot, even if Romney isn't successful.
Well, one of the assumptions about how the Republicans have organized, and largely through the efforts of Karl Rove, one of the explanations that I've heard is that the Republican alliance with the religious right, who are becoming increasingly dominant part of the Republican coalition, has had the effect of providing the Republicans with the same kind of assets that the Democrats have always had with labor unions, the people who drive people to the poll, the people who knock on doors, the people who lick stamps and make phone calls, and that the religious right has offered up these mega churches and stuff as that, as the Republican infrastructure to match what the Democrats have always had an advantage in. Of course, you know, one of the reasons why the Republicans have gone after public employee labor unions is to defund the Democrats. So they've been quite aggressive, and we know that labor unions are down to only 6% of representation of the private workforce. Give us a sense, Li Fong, of what role do these fundamentalist megachurches play?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right in that the religious right has played this counterbalance role for Republicans for, I would say, three decades. You know, I actually argue in my book that's coming out in the late winter that the religious right coalition began falling apart in 2006, 2007 because of the wave of scandals that rocked the Republican Party, everything from Foley to Larry Craig. Republican planners, lobbyists, they saw that their ground troops were losing enthusiasm, so they started making investments in groups like Americans for Prosperity. It's creating organizations like American Majority. That's another group that has four or five field offices in Ohio that are undisclosed, that are augmenting the Romney ground game. So they started investing in these new types of groups. At the same time, they started going on offense against public employee unions, knowing that to make up for the lost volunteers, the evangelicals who are just less hardcore Republican than they were before, they had to go after Democrats' assets, as you would say. So, you know, that's why even the president of the Wisconsin State Senate, when they were going after the public employees there, he admitted very openly that the reason that they were doing this was to hope to deliver Wisconsin for Romney this year. It was transparently political, even though the ads and, you know, Governor Walker always tried to remind the press that this was about the budget, you know, somehow saving money. But several of the people involved in the effort were honest in saying that, no, this is about a partisan effort. So, you know, the dynamics are changing. The religious right will still be important in this election. Ralph Reed, the former president of a large Christian religious right group in the 90s, has kind of re-entered the fray. He has a new group called Faith and Freedom Coalition that's working very closely with Americans for Prosperity. They're sharing the same database. And I think it's yet to be seen the type of impact he'll have, but they sure are trying. There are many large evangelical churches in Ohio. They might tip the balance in this election.
Well, just in closing, Li Fong, Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers super PAC, Adelson super PAC, Vandersloot super PAC, and all of these other super PACs, we know how much money they're pouring. We don't know how many. That's the point. We don't know how much money they're pouring. We know that they have a lot of money at their disposal. We know they're saturating the airwaves and going to do carpet bombing advertisements. And so we know that what they've done in terms of paid media. So give us a sense of what you think this hidden kind of beneath the surface ground game that the Republicans have developed through the plutocrats, the ones that we've been talking about, activities. This could be, you know, the stealth operation of all stealth operations.
Well, the surprise will come on Election Day. I mean, you gave the Harry Reid example where he's kind of stunned the pollsters just by getting people out to vote. As you mentioned, he has religious connections in the state. He also has very big casino connections. They were out busing people to the polls. So that's another example of how a corporation can really make a big difference come Election Day. But, you know, for this presidential election, it's really hard to predict. Enthusiasm for Democrats is incredibly low. That being said, Romney, I don't think, is a strong candidate. So it still kind of hangs in the balance. Where you see, in my opinion, this ground game having the most effect is down ballot, because bringing people out to vote for these pivotal Senate races and House races where people aren't paying attention like they are in the presidential race is going to have a huge impact in the shape of Congress next year in Ohio. Even if Romney somehow loses the state, which is very possible, I think with Americans for Prosperity and all these outside dark money groups coming in, you're going to see some of these pivotal House races either flip to the Republicans or stay in the Republicans' hands. You have Jim Renacci, this Tea Party freshman Republican, who has was in danger just a few months ago. I think a lot of these outside money efforts are going to keep him in office. Across the country, I don't think Democrats are going to be able to take back the House. But again, you know, monitoring how these groups get out the vote is going to be very important. I just can't stress enough, you can't just compare the Obama versus Romney campaigns, because the dynamics are just so different in this election. So much of the political resources are outsourced to these third-party groups.
Well, Lee Fong, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lee Fong, who's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He covers money and politics, conservative movements, and lobbying. His work has resulted in multiple calls for hearings in Congress and the Federal Elections Commission. His book on the campaign to block Obama's domestic priorities is slated for publication this winter, and he has an article at the Nation, "Does Romney Actually Have a Bigger Ground Game Than Obama?" We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Proposition 34 with someone who was wrongfully convicted and spent 26 years in a California prison for a crime he did not commit.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us in the studio is Bruce Liske, who in March of 1984, at the age of 17, was wrongly convicted of brutally murdering his mother in their Los Angeles home. Despite proclaiming his innocence, Bruce Liske was sentenced to life imprisonment and sent off to San Quentin. On August the 13th, 2009, a federal judge overturned Liske's conviction, and to the accompaniment of TV cameras and front page headlines, he was released from a California prison after serving 26 years for a crime he did not commit. The injustice Bruce Liske suffered has received widespread media attention, more than 50 articles in the Los Angeles Times, and was profiled in a recent 48 Hours mystery episode. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Liske.
Thank you, Ian.
And Bruce, I know it's painful, but if you could just take us back to March of 1984, where your nightmare began.
Yeah. It was a long, long time ago. It was March 10th, 1983. My mother was supposed to be home. I had come over to fix my car. I'd had a problem with my car, and she was normally she would come out on the patio on the front porch when I would arrive. and this morning she didn't. And so I went to the door and knocked, and there was still no answer. I began looking in windows, and then from the rear of the residence, I saw her on the floor. And so, having returned my front door key when I moved out, I had to break in through the kitchen window, and I found her. She had been stabbed and beaten and left for dead. And I called the paramedics and the police, called my father, called, everybody that I needed to help. I was hysterical. I was completely out of my mind, screaming, crying, didn't know how to relate to any of what I had found. It was just horrendous. Administered first aid, as the paramedics instructed, and waited for the police and begged her to say something to me, to tell me who had done this to her. But she was unconscious. She was breathing, but she was unconscious. And when the paramedics arrived, they began treating her. And when the police arrived, almost simultaneously, they arrested me. They wrestled me to the ground, put me in handcuffs. I was screaming for the paramedics to get my mother to the hospital, to hurry and help her, to do something. And I was pacing, and I couldn't stop pacing. And the police wrestled me to the ground and put me in handcuffs. And that was essentially the last I saw of my freedom.
And your father was an attorney and,
yes.
and fairly politically conservative, I understand.
He was indeed. Yeah.
And he tried to intervene, I imagine, immediately. But it looks like the police had made up their mind from the very first moment. Is that
They certainly did. Yeah, they rushed a judge, and then they wouldn't let anything sort of, impede that course. I mean, they wouldn't let, don't bother me with the facts. I've made my mind up.
And was this the police in general or one particular policeman?
There was one particular police detective in specific, Andrew Monsu, the Van Nuys homicide, and then he had a partner. But then it was really, it extended out from him. He was essentially the center of the ripple in the pond, and there were other officers and police personnel that went along with him.
So he not only not believing a 17-year-old kid who just lost his mother and is in psychic shock, but he doesn't believe your father, a conservative attorney?
No, not at all. He initially tried to enlist my father by asking him, well, how many problems did you – you guys had a lot of problems at home, Bruce and his mother, right, and emphasizing that rather than just simple, every teenager has difficulties at home, that sort of aspect. He focused in on that. And when my father wouldn't essentially capitulate and add to the mountain of – false evidence he was assembling, they wrote him off. They stopped answering his calls. They stopped responding to him.
So the next stage is a trial where you're convicted. And clearly, you didn't have adequate counsel.
Indeed. That was the case. I had my attorney actually had in his hand an interview transcript with the person everybody now believes murdered my mother, wherein this person tries to account for his whereabouts, tries to establish himself an alibi, a blood alibi, in fact, as well. Tries to say he was 12 miles away at the time of the crime, checking into a motel. Tries to say, he got in a knife fight with some unnamed black guy. And that's why, presumably to create a blood alibi. And his money doesn't stretch, et cetera, et cetera. And my attorney had this transcript in his hands when we were arguing a motion whether or not this man's name could be mentioned in front of the jury. And my attorney just completely dismally failed, So, yeah, ineffective assistance.
But you weren't aware of this because you're still too young.
You're in such bewilderment. You were just literally, every time you step into court, you're just, high anxiety, an adrenaline response every time you step in those doors. And they're trying to take away your life, quite literally. And
They did.
And they did for 26.
26 years. And tell us about how finally – not that justice has been served in this case, because you're still suing the LAPD. Yeah. But how were you finally released?
Through a lot of good, hard detective work and a very dedicated private investigator by the name of Paul Ingalls, who was a Pomona cop for 10 years and is now a private investigator. He is just absolutely amazing. After the money ran out, he continued working on my case, and he was so dedicated because he saw the truth. There have been other, as yet, unsung heroes. There, James Gavin of the Internal Affairs, Van Nuys. He essentially reinvestigated the murder and came up with all kinds of promising, leads and laboratory results and such.
But the cop who railroaded you, he essentially retired, right?
Essentially, he actually did retire full you know, full retirement,
right.
Money's in the bank. And he, in fact, said that to the LA Times rather arrogantly, I think, when they were confronting him with some of the facts that didn't match what he had claimed. He said, you know, look, I got my money in the bank. I got 30 years on, you know, right. Don't bother me with these incidental details.
Well, he wasn't the brightest bulb, was he, in the LAPD, didn't he?
Well, I think he took the quiz for to become a lieutenant some 56 times or something right. like that. I don't know.
Right. But he had the power to destroy your life.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate.
So,
fact.
And then fortunately, finally, a federal judge was able to overturn it, and the widespread media attention that your case got, you have to thank the L.A. Times. They did a great job, and
Absolutely.
Also, it's also worth pointing out that newspapers such as the L.A. Times, which is in financial trouble, and Rupert Murdoch is threatening to buy it, they're no longer investing in investigative journalism because it costs money and usually provides legal headaches for the paper. So you are truly walking free, right, because of investigative journalism.
That's absolutely correct, yeah. And if anything speaks to the need to for these institutions to continue to fund these types of things, it's me and cases like mine, where without such financial and intensive investigative backing, I might not be sitting in front of you. I might not be here. I might still be languishing in prison for something I didn't do. And it's such a sorely needed thing. And yet, with the internet, and it's much easier not to print a paper. It's much easier not to invest in these long investigations.
So let's turn to the subject, which is why I'm talking with you, Bruce. Although I think your story is so extraordinary, it needs to be told as often as possible. But it does serve as a kind of an example of what could happen. If you were just 1 year older at the time when you were railroaded, you would have been eligible for the death penalty.
That's correct. In fact, it was 3 months.
3 months.
I was just 3 months from being 18. And right. had I been 18, there was an allegation of theft, and murder in the commission of another felony makes you eligible for special circumstances and the death penalty in California. So indeed, that's correct.
And so you're campaigning on behalf of Proposition 34, which would ban the death penalty in the state of California, but it has national implications, surely, because recently in the state of, I think it was Kansas, a very conservative state, the death penalty was almost overturned, was one vote shy of being overturned. Mm-hmm. So if California overturns its death penalty, it's likely to have widespread national implications. So give us your argument for why people should vote for yes on Prop 34.
Well, I mean, primarily, Prop 34 in California replaces the death penalty with life without the possibility of parole. That means the person who's sentenced to this punishment will not see the streets again. He'll never darken our doorsteps. He'll never be a threat to us again. So it's no less safe than the death penalty. And it saves so much money. I mean, we waste colossal amounts of money housing men and women in death row, most of whom die of natural causes or of suicide. They don't. The sentence is never carried out. And yet we're spending all the money as if it was going to be carried out and that justice would be done in that manner. And we wind up just wasting on it. We could save that much money. We could house them as regular prisoners, life withouts. In addition, they'd be working. If when Prop 34 passes, they'll be working, have jobs, contribute to the victim's restitution fund rather than just sitting in a cell costing us money. They'll be paying something back. And I think that it's for fiscal reasons and for moral reasons. Personally, it's a moral issue for me. I'm against the death penalty, most importantly, obviously, because of my personal situation in life.
But you're an educated white guy from the San Fernando Valley.
Yes.
And you got railroaded.
That's,
imagine how many minorities, blacks and Hispanics, are on death row or in jails who've been railroaded.
Absolutely. And I'm such a minority in terms of prison population. I'm so if it could happen to a white kid, a son of an attorney from Sherman Oaks, California, this can happen to anybody. And it makes me shudder how many folks it does happen to. It happens with shocking regularity, false convictions, wrongful convictions, putting innocent people in prison, in harm's way. And I'm also in the distinct minority of people who've been able to prove their innocence. And so we sentence somebody to death. We have no means of correcting that. when and if the evidence comes out that we have indeed done that. We give them life without the possibility of parole. At least we can bring them home. We could make some sort of recompense. We could try to do something for them. You can't unring a bell and you can't unkill a prisoner. So again,
I'm speaking with Bruce Liske, who at the age of 17 was wrongly convicted of brutally murdering his mother. He was sentenced to life imprisonment and spent 26 years in San Quentin until the federal judge overturned his conviction in August of 2009. He is suing the LAPD, and largely because of the work, the investigative work of the Los Angeles Times, who brought attention to his wrongful conviction, he is now a free man and is campaigning on behalf of Proposition 34 on this California ballot, which again, as I mentioned, has national implications, because California often sets that in the worst sense, we set the stage for three strikes, you know. And and if we if the state of California overturns the death penalty, it's likely to have very, very positive national implications. So let's get into the mechanics of the of what this proposition is going to do. It saves about, what, $200 million a year?
That's correct.
So, but that money is apparently going to be used. A portion of that money is going to be used to actually do what the police should be doing, which they don't do, largely because of, you know, lack of funding, et cetera. Close how many unsolved cases? I mean, how many murders go unsolved?
I believe it's 46% every year, and 56% of rapes are unsolved. And this will take $100 million and immediately shunt it directly to that. Solve these crimes. Here's the funding. Here's everything that you need.
So these are cold cases mostly.
These are essentially cold cases. And
rape kits that haven't been tested.
That's correct. As I understand it, and I don't want to say that as an absolute fact, but as I understand it, there are a number of rape kits that are sitting untested, thousands. Yeah. And just the funding just isn't there currently to do that.
And so you know that women who get raped quite often don't even want to go through the extra humiliation of having a test.
Absolutely.
So the idea that they are doubly penalized, and then on top of that, because of lack of funding, these kits aren't even tested for DNA. So they're because of lack of funding. So this could, if this passes, this could be a win-win for the community, surely.
I think it's a win-win all the way around. I mean, absolutely. You know, you get the benefit of cost savings, and you get the benefit of making society a little bit safer, you know, making the public a little bit safer and solving these crimes.
So tell us about your life, you know, which has been essentially put on hold for 26 years, from the age of 17 till, what, do the math.
44.
Yeah. You don't seem to me to be a bitter man. I mean, I imagine most of us listening, and I myself would just be, you know, I don't know how you survived.
Well, thank you. It's not easy. But, you know, you just put one foot in front of the other. You have your good days, you have your bad days. You do the best that you possibly can with what you're given. I think for everybody living, today's the first day of the rest of your life, and what's that life going to look like? And I think that when we can envision ourselves as, you know, captains of that vessel rather than simply riding along, I think that we, you know, we're well on our way to try to sort of dealing well with anything that comes our way, including negatives like this. But, you know, I mean, I must say I have my days. I you know, thank you for the compliment, but it's quite difficult. I mean, it's nigh unto impossible to find a job when you have to put yes to that question, have you ever been arrested for a felony? Because truthfully, yes, I have. And then they say, what was it? And I say, well, murder. I was exonerated. And you sometimes begin to wonder, do they understand what exonerated means? Because I haven't gotten literally, you know, 50 job applications go in and not one callback. And so it's a struggle. It's an uphill struggle, but I'm not going to ever give up. And it's just...
And what about your suit against the LAPD? Is it specifically against this one detective who railroaded you?
It's against he and his partner and the LAPD at large and the city of Los Angeles as well. You have to sort of inclusively, I think, these are legal considerations.
You're suing City Hall. Is it? That's the old expression, right?
Yeah.
Taking on City Hall. That's an uphill climb.
Yeah.
How long have you been at it, and how long before you think you'll?
It's been several years, but I mean, again, just as dealing with, you know, the whole trauma, you just have to keep moving forward and keep pushing forward with it. I'm not apologetic towards City Hall. City Hall didn't reach out and really help me for 26 years. So I think that they, you know, not that I'm bitter. Again, I'm not.
But this is why it's so hard to get exonerated, isn't it? It's the system doesn't want to admit it made a mistake because it doesn't want to have to pay for the mistake.
It's excruciatingly difficult to be exonerated. The gears of that slow grind of justice turn very well in one direction, although albeit slow. They really resist, you know, turning in the opposite direction, even when it's justified. And you really have to go through all kinds of machinations to try to make it happen. And eventually, years later. And it's always west of Memphis, there was a quote, Eddie Vedder said that it takes 10, 15 years for these things to happen, these exonerations. And it is. It's absolutely right. True. It doesn't happen overnight.
But conversely, the you get railroaded as quick as they can.
Absolutely. Yeah. As I said, the gears do turn rather efficiently in the other direction.
Right. Yeah. So what's your sense of where Prop 34 stands now? It's fairly close, isn't it?
It is close.
It's gaining, I understand.
It is gaining just a bit. It was neck and neck just about a week ago, and we're a bit better than that now. We do need to get awareness out. We do need to make people aware of what this measure is. It's not soft on crime. It's actually tougher on crime.
Because it actually takes money that would otherwise be wasted, in effect, on a broken system. It takes that money and dedicates it towards solving unsolved crimes. And I'm sure it comes as a shock to our listeners to learn that, what, over 40% of homicides are not convicted?
That's correct. There's 46 unsolved.
Unsolved.
Have no idea. The police have no idea, have not been able to ascertain who is responsible for that crime. And so literally 46% of all murders, there's a murderer walking around, you know, minus the few that might get caught up for another crime and just, you know, happenstance find themselves in prison.
Another statistical and grim way to look at it is that a murderer could kill 46 people before they get caught.
That is another way to look at it.
And then on top of that, what's the statistics on unsolved rapes?
It's 56.
56. So the money that would be saved in Proposition 34 by abolishing the death penalty and substituting it with life in prison without any possibility of parole, that money would be then dedicated to all of these cold cases.
Indeed.
So, I mean, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. The decision is yours. I thank you for joining us, Bruce.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Liske, who in March of 1984, at the age of 17, was wrongly convicted of brutally murdering his mother in their Los Angeles home. Despite proclaiming his innocence, Bruce Liske was sentenced to life imprisonment and sent off to San Quentin. On August the 13th of 2009, a federal judge overturned Liske's conviction, and to the accompaniment of TV cameras and front page headlines, he was released from a California prison after serving 26 years for a crime he did not commit. The injustice Bruce Liske suffered has received widespread media attention, a lot of investigative work by the Los Angeles Times, and a recent 48 Hours mystery episode. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at Facebook/IanMastersMedia. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time one night.